Good evening. This is Life Rattle, the story show. I'm your host, Lori Callis. Tonight, on Life Rattle number 1288, we bring you a special Christmas program featuring a Life Rattle classic by Renate Kellhammer and a fabulous new story by Andrew Iamaki. Our first writer tonight, Renate Kellhammer, came to Canada in 1957, a year after her husband immigrated from Germany. After a month in Montreal, the couple moved to Kitchener, where they lived for 6 years before settling in what is now Mississauga. Kellhammer raised three children while she worked part-time at a bank and went to university part-time, graduating in 1999. But it is her life before she came to Canada, which forms the basis for the story we're going to hear on tonight's program, from a series of stories that Renate Kellhammer has written about growing up in Germany during the Second World War. Kellhammer was born in Stuttgart in 1933, the same year that Adolf Hitler was appointed Chancellor of Germany. She spent the first 12 years of her life under Hitler's Nazi dictatorship. By the time she was 8 years old, she did not know what peace meant and could remember only the hardship and destitution of war. Kellhammer's stories take us behind the front lines and show in vivid scenes and incidents the deteriorating effects of war on the unfortunate civilian population. The story we feature tonight takes place in Germany in December 1944, when an 11-year-old girl, long evacuated from her home city, journeys back to Stuttgart with her mother for the holidays. Renate describes her passage back on the train, beneath constant air raids and surrounded by absolute devastation, and tells of people with incredible strength of character and stoic practicality. The immensity of Renate Kellhammer's story is beyond my ability to summarize. My words feel woefully inadequate. Thank you, Renate, for sharing the story with us and for reminding me of how lucky I am to have shared a season of celebration with friends and family. Let's listen now as Renate Kellhammer reads her story, The Christmas Angel, tonight on Life Rattle.
The Christmas Angel by Renate Kellhammer. These were the dark times in Germany. December 1944. I was 11. I had lived away from home for a long time. The government had ordered all German school children evacuated from the cities because of the frequent air raids. Now Mama came to Biberach, where I stayed with distant relatives, to get me home for the Christmas holidays in Stuttgart. I was so excited. I could not sleep. I could not eat. This was unusual, since all of us were hungry all the time. Mama arrived late in the evening. She looked pale, sick, dusty and disheveled, ready to drop from exhaustion. What happened, Mama? It was pretty bad. It took me all day to get here. Ulm is burning. We decided to wait till the morning to start the journey home. Mama was much too tired. Mama had no energy to talk anymore about her trip. "I hope we'll make it home all right," she whispered. Next morning we took the earliest train north. We usually changed trains in the town of Ulm when we traveled home to Stuttgart. Normally the 30-kilometer distance took less than 1 hour. But because of the constant air attacks on the railways, the train ride took most of the day. Whenever fighter planes came into view, the engineer stopped the train and blew the steam whistle. The passengers then got out and ran for cover. The anti-aircraft gun on the last car blasted away at the attackers. When the planes left, the whistle blew again. Two short blasts, and the people climbed back on the train, and the journey continued until the next attack. When we got there, there was not much left of Ulm. Most of the town was destroyed. People dug in the rubble of what used to be their homes. But now it was dark, except for the burning buildings, which colored the sky orange. We coughed from the acrid stench of the fires. Every one of the railroad bridges across the River Danube was destroyed by bombs. Our train came to a stop at a blown-up bridge. The passengers got out and walked along the railway bed towards the river. Coarse stones on the embankment made walking hard. The older people stumbled. Some lost their luggage in the dark. At the river, some rowboats ferried people across the Danube. We had to wait a long time for our turn. Many of the passengers shouted, shoved, and argued. At the other side of the river, we had to climb up another steep embankment. We looked for our train. Locomotives and railway cars stood all over the place. The damaged ones needed uncoupling and were pulled aside. The railroad workers inspected the tracks for missing sections. Nobody knew where to go in the dark. Burning buildings offered the only light. A stout farm woman with a large pillowcase full of parcels and a bag walked beside us. She wore a thick beige coat, about two sizes too small for her, and a colorful kerchief on her head. We said hello. "Where are you two gypsies going?" she grinned. "We are looking for the train to Stuttgart," I said. "Well, ain't that funny? So am I. We'll have to find somebody who knows his way around this mess." She shouted at a trainman, "Hey, which way is the train to Stuttgart?" Booming voice carried through the clamor. A railway policeman pointed us in the right direction. Mama was glad that we had found somebody who could take charge. She was too exhausted herself. It seemed like hours until we found what was left of the Stuttgart train. The cars were already packed tight with people. We had to push our way in. Around midnight, the train started to move slowly northward. The windows on the railway cars all painted black. Tiny squares left in the middle allowed us to look out and see where we were. There was not a lot of lighting at the stations, so it was hard to read the names of the towns. No light was permitted in the cars because of the blackout. The authorities were afraid that enemy airplanes could see the lights of the trains and start attacking them again. "Why bother? I think the Allies have found these trains already, blackout or not," said the woman. Everybody laughed. She wanted to know all about me. I felt comfortable talking to her. I sat down beside her. Mama sat on her suitcase in the aisle and tried to sleep. People were taking turns to share the seats. Sometimes in the early morning, we neared Stuttgart. The woman asked me, "What have you got in your rucksack there?" I opened it up and showed her my sweater and socks. "Good. You have room in there for this." She took a whole chicken out of that huge pillowcase of hers and put it in my rucksack. "You look all starved, you poor little thing. Merry Christmas," and she got quickly off the train. Mama still dozed in the aisle. I sat stunned. I pushed my way over to Mama and shook her awake. "Mama, look what the lady gave me." Mama rubbed her eyes. "Where is she? Did you say thank you?" Chicken meant unimaginable riches to us. Our ration cards allowed everyone only to buy one loaf of bread a week, 100 grams of margarine, 1 liter of skim milk for children under 12, and some potatoes. We had seen no meat for a long time. When we reached home, our exhaustion had disappeared. "Look what we brought for Christmas." Oma and Tante Grete were very happy. This chicken would feed Oma, Tante Grete, Mama and me for at least a week. The huge white hen still had all its feathers, the head and the feet. to us it was a special gift from the Christkind. The Christkind used to come unseen to German children on Christmas Eve and put the presents under the tree. This year we had no Christmas tree. A few trees brought into the city were only for families with children under 10 years old. I was 11. We had no lights, no candles, no presents, only a chicken. We never celebrated another Christmas together anymore. Both Oma and Tante Grete died soon after the war ended.
That was The Christmas Angel, written and read by Renate Kellhammer. Tonight's second reader, Andrew Ayamaki, was born in Peterborough in 1989, the youngest of three children. At age 12, he moved from a city of more than 72,000 to the small farming village of Cambrai, just north of Lindsay. It was a culture shock for him, trading sidewalks and parks for expanding fields of hay and soy. Andrew Ayamaki grew up an avid sports fan, playing all sorts of sport with a penchant for hockey, and also developed a love for visual art. He finds inspiration in the contrast between the rules and organized structure of competitive sport and the inventiveness and open-ended creativity of visual art. Andrew's story brings us into the world of a child on Christmas Day. The experience is magical. Let's listen now as Andrew Ayamaki reads his story, The Amazing Jumpin' Jiminy.
The Amazing Jumpin' Jiminy by Andrew Ayamaki. Mom drives onto the shoulder of Highway 7 and then turns into my grandparents' laneway. Gravel wraps around the house in an L shape and swells with the congestion of 20 cars, and now ours. My brother Sean sits in the passenger seat with his head buried in his Sega Game Gear, and my sister Beth sits in the back beside me, hugging the neck of Victor Melvin, her Cabbage Patch doll. Mom parks the car behind Uncle Joe and Aunt Judy's Jeep. I stare out the window at the pristine snow that covers the front lawn. The spray of brown sludge thrown from the passing plows piles at the front of the lawn by the highway. Two black-faced lawn jockeys, holding lanterns with icicles hanging from the corners, stand between two spruce trees near the front of the house. Their black faces stand out against the bluish-gray siding, and frost covers their bodies. Sean and Beth rip off their seatbelts and rush out of the car towards the house. I reach for the latch on my seatbelt, but the wool of my mittens makes my hand slip off the buckle, the attached strings catching my sweater. Mom, I scream, I can't get out. She looks at me through the rearview mirror. Just a sec, hon. Mom places a cigarette in her mouth. The white of the cigarette clenched between her lips contrasts the raven color of her hair and the vibrant red sheen of her bomber jacket. She presses the car's interior lighter, and when it pops out, she brings the glowing rings to her face. Mom breathes in and then exhales before she opens her door to come and free me. I squeeze the soft body of the green Power Ranger toy I hold in my arms and nuzzle its cold plastic face against mine. Mom opens the door and I feel the frigid December air on my cheeks. She releases my seatbelt, picks me up, and carries me to the front door with the cigarette dangling from her mouth. She kicks the snow off her boots and then opens the door to the kitchen. Grandpa stands by the sink holding a glass of rye and water. He greets us with Merry Christmas. Mom puts me down on the floor. Merry Christmas, she says. I kick off my boots, throw my jacket onto the heap of coats, and run out of the kitchen. "Andrew," Mom yells, "get back here. Your grandpa is talking to you." I press the weight of my body onto the hardwood floor and slide to a stop in my damp socks. I race back. "Was Santa Claus good to you this year?" Grandpa asks. "Yes," I scream. "He gave me this." I hold the green Power Ranger toy up to my grandfather's face. His red bulbous nose holds the weight of his bifocal lenses. His black eyebrows arc upwards on his face. Grandpa smiles. His cheeks plump and turn red in seconds. When he starts talking to Mom again, I scurry away. I follow the sound of laughter coming from the basement and skate down the hallway on my socks. I reach the door to the basement and turn the large brass knob. "Sean Robert," I hear my grandmother yell in the basement. I only hear my brother's middle name used when my mom or grandma yells at him. I hear his middle name a lot. I stand at the top of the landing and peer through thick smoke that distorts the image of the floor at the bottom of the staircase. The pale wooden stairs that descend into the basement are bare. The untreated wood warms my feet. I'm afraid of the stairs. They descend at an angle so steep that I always think I'll fall forward, tumble down, and break my neck. I plop myself down on the first step and place my Power Ranger toy on my lap. I slowly bum my way down the stairs. My corduroy pants rub on each step, sounding like a wave crashing onto the shore, followed by the thud of my backside. I pause to collect myself after each thud. I stand up when I reach the bottom and see my entire extended family through a forest of legs, scattered around the basement with smokes in their mouths and drinks in their hands. "Merry Christmas, Buckwheat," Aunt Louise says as I pass her. "Was Santa good to you this year?" "Yes," I scream again. "He gave me this." I shove the Power Ranger toy up to her face, just like I did with Grandpa. "That's nice." She turns and talks to her husband, Uncle John. I shrug and walk to the table loaded with food. My eyes barely clear the top as I search for something to eat. Grandma's jigsaw puzzle lies underneath a sheet of plexiglass on the table. I can see from the skewed half-finished puzzle and the spray of random pieces that the picture is supposed to be of three Labrador retrievers, black, golden, and chocolate. I peer at a wall of beer bottles and a minefield of Labatt's Blue and Carling Light bottle caps and search for a treat. I see on the other side of the table a plate filled with small cakes and cookies, and beside it are a few shards of Grandma's treacle toffee. I can't reach them, so I settle for a small cube of marble cheese and a slice of Pillar's Polish coil on the plate closest to me. I pop the cheese into my mouth and peel off the casing of the meat. "Andrew!" I cringe and almost choke on the food in my mouth when I hear my grandmother call me. "Yes, Grandma? Was Santa Claus good to you this year?" "Yes," I point to the toy in my hand. "He gave me this." "What is that?" she asks. "It's a Power Ranger," I tell her. "Everybody knows that." She stares blankly at me. Then she finishes the last swallow of her Carling Light and hands me the brown bottle. They're in the cold storage. I know. I place my Power Ranger on the table and head to the cold storage in the laundry room. "Grab me one too," I hear, followed by the collective drone of "Yeah, me too." I open the door to the laundry room and drag my feet along the frigid cement floor. The heater hums and clicks as I shuffle by, and then stops. I reach the second door at the end of the laundry room that leads to the cold storage and the beer. I open it. The faint light from behind me shines into the cavernous room and exposes the outline of a single light bulb that hangs in the middle of the room. I notice the small nub of plastic at the end of a white string dangling from the light bulb, but I'm too short to pull it. I slowly edge myself into the room. The darkness swells around me. My heart beats fast. I stop and take a look around me. I can't see much in the darkness, except for my grandfather's muddy hunting boots and the sleeve of his bright orange coat. The room feels like it's swallowing me. I picture myself standing in the stomach of a big scary beast. My heart rattles in my chest. I shiver in fear. I take a few running steps, jump, and grab onto the dangling string, pulling it down with me as I fall to the cement. The light reveals cases filled with empty beer bottles that line three walls, six cases high and two deep. By the last wall stands a chest freezer. On top of the lid lays a bowl with stuffing and a platter with the pre-cooked turkey for tomorrow night's Christmas dinner that Grandma and Grandpa hold on Boxing Day. I lift up the tinfoil on the turkey and pick at the bits of stuffing that cling to the inside of the bird's cavity. I crinkle the foil as I cover the turkey and spill a few small pieces of stuffing. I kick them underneath the freezer. I see an open 2-4 on my right. I place Grandma's empty in one of the open slots and grab seven full bottles of beer for the drink order. I hug them close to my body and slowly shuffle my feet so that the bounce of my step doesn't set one of the bottles falling and smashing to the floor. I can't reach the doorknob without dropping one of the bottles, so I bang my head on the door. No one hears me. I shiver and bang my head three more times. Uncle Joe opens the door. His big round eyes mirror his big round cheeks as he smiles through the thick beard on his face. "Thank you," I say, and walk past him. The warm air mixed with cigarette and cigar smoke scrapes the lining of my throat and enters my lungs. I walk over to Uncle John. He slides one of the long-necked bottles from my grasp. I make my way through the line of uncles until I reach my grandmother. I hand her the last bottle, and she thanks me. "We're supposed to get a lot of snow this year," Uncle Bob tells Grandpa, who had come downstairs and perched himself beside Grandma while I was getting the beer for everyone. The top of his head glows from the fluorescent light above him, casting a white patch on his scalp that stands out beside the black ring of hair on his head. His hands lay one on top of the other on his large belly. "That's what I hear," Grandpa says. "Supposed to be a cold one, too." Grandpa sips his rye and water. His eyes cross when he stares at the bottom of the glass, then licks the remaining dribble of his drink from the corner of his mouth. Uncle Bob sips his Caesar, dodging the celery stalk, and licks the salt from his lips. "A real cold one," they say in unison. I walk over to Sean, sitting on the black vinyl couch with his face still buried in his Sega Game Gear. "Can I play?" I ask. He ignores me. "Hey," I yell as I grab his hand. "Let me play." Sean swings his fist and plants it on my left arm. "You screwed up my game." My eyes well up. Sean pushes me out of his way as he gets up from the couch and moves to the other side of the basement. "How is Santa Claus to you this year?" I hear from behind me. "Did he bring you anything good?" It's Uncle Joe. "Yeah, I got a Power Ranger. It's over there." I point to the table with the food, still teary-eyed. "Did I ever tell you about my friend Jiminy Cricket?" "No." "Well, he's a very special friend of mine, but he's really shy and only comes out on special occasions." "Christmas is a special occasion. Where is he?" I ask. "He's sleeping. He was out late last night helping Santa deliver all those toys. Probably even helped deliver that one over there." He points to my green Power Ranger. "He's a very busy little guy. Maybe if you're really quiet and still, he'll come out to play." "Really?" I shout and jump into the air. "Yes, but," Uncle Joe leans in and whispers, "he's shy, remember. You have to be quiet." "Okay," I whisper. Uncle Joe sits down and sets his drink on the table. "Remember, you have to stay still and quiet." I nod and smile. He grasps the bottom button of his red and blue flannel shirt with his left index finger and thumb. He twists the button through the hole. He moves up his shirt and unbuttons two more, exposing his belly button through a tangle of coarse black hairs. I'll have to see if he's awake, he says. I wait as Uncle Joe inserts the index finger on his right hand into his belly button. He moves his finger around the walls of Jiminy's home. This may take a bit, he says. His room is way in the back. Is he awake, Uncle Joe? I ask excitedly. Is Jiminy awake? I think so, he says. Remember, you have to be quiet. He's very shy. Uncle Joe removes his finger from his belly button and reveals Jiminy lying on the tip of his finger. I move closer to examine him. Jiminy's blue body is hairier than I had imagined. Jiminy lies curled up into a ball with fine streaks of white and red thread that twist around his body. Jiminy smells funny, I whisper to Uncle Joe, so I don't startle Jiminy. He forgot to shower this morning, Uncle Joe grins, then places Jiminy on his knee. He almost disappears on Uncle Joe's faded blue Dickies pants stained from working on his farm. I remain quiet and still. I don't want to scare Jiminy. Is he still sleeping? I ask. He's not moving very much. Just wait, Uncle Joe says. It takes him a little while to warm up. He's shy, remember? I stare intently at Jiminy Cricket, waiting for something to happen. Andrew. Andrew, I hear across the room. Grandma holds up another empty bottle of Carling Light. Not now, Grandma, I whisper. I don't want to scare Jiminy. Joe, pull down your shirt, Aunt Judy says. Nobody wants to see that. The sound of laughter erupts in the room, but I don't take my eyes off Uncle Joe's knee. Did you know that Jiminy worked in the circus before he started working for Santa Claus? Uncle Joe says with a grin on his face. People used to call him the amazing Jumpin' Jiminy because he could jump 20 times further than any other cricket. Are you sure he's still not sleeping, Uncle Joe? I ask. I've been quiet and I haven't moved for 5 whole minutes. Don't take your eyes off of him. He takes in a huge gulp of air and holds it in. Just watch. I stare at Jiminy. Nothing happens. Jiminy leaps off his knee and lands near Uncle Joe's toes on the floor. Whoa, I shout. That was amazing. Bring him here and we'll see if he'll do it again, Uncle Joe chuckles to himself. Okay. I run to the spot where Jiminy landed and bend over and pick him up.
That was Andrew Iamaki reading his story, The Amazing Jumpin' Jiminy. This concludes Life Rattle number 1288. My name is Lori Callis. Arne Ackman recorded Renate Kellhammer reading The Christmas Angel. I recorded Andrew Iamaki reading The Amazing Jumpin' Jiminy. Be sure to tune in next week, next year, for a Life Rattle classic program, hosted by Virginia Ashbury. Thank you.